Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Thursday, December 3rd session of the Portland City Council. Please call the roll.
Novick?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman? Hales?
I believe Commissioner Saltzman is joining us this afternoon. We'll see. We have two items on the agenda today. Do you want them both read together?
May they be read together.
Yes, sir. They may. Please read the items.
1261. Approve findings to authorize an exemption to the competitive bidding requirements, authorize a competitive solicitation for use of the design-build alternative contracting method, and authorize payment for construction related to the Willamette River Crossing Project for an estimated amount of $40 million. And 1262, authorize a formal qualifications-based selection request for proposal process and contract for owner's representative services related to the Willamette River Crossing Project for an estimated amount of $4 million.
Commissioner Fish.
Thank you, Madam President. It's a great honor for the Water Bureau today to present the Willamette River Crossing to the Council and to seek our collective approval for moving forward. We're joined today by the Director, Michael Sturer, the Chief Engineer, Teresa Elliott, and Christine Moody, the Chief Procurement Officer for the City of Portland. And I'll introduce Mike to take it away.
Madam President and Commissioners, first, thank you for agreeing to spend part of your afternoon with us. We look forward to talking about this very important project for the city. I frame this project primarily in terms of seismic resilience. As you know, and Teresa will explain in more detail, our various crossings that we have across the river right now that feed the central downtown are not likely to survive an earthquake. We desperately need to be able to provide water on the west side of the river, and that is the purpose of this project. There are some 130,000 Portlanders that live on the west side of the river, and we also supply wholesale contractors on the west side of the river. So this project is extremely important. I'm joined by Teresa Elliott, our Bureau's new chief engineer, and Christine Moody, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Teresa.
Good afternoon. Portland Water Bureau serves over 32,000 services on the west side of the Willamette River. This is about 20% of all of our services that we provide. Including in that is three of our major hospital complexes, the OHSU, Good Samaritan, and Veterans Administration. It's also the hub of all of the government services in the Portland metro area. And to us, the west side is extremely important and essential in normal day activities as well as immediately following an earthquake. Economically, we generate in the Portland metro area on the west side of town alone $8.2 billion. So getting water across the river is extremely important to us. But our biggest risk is the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. We figure that about 15%, we have a 15% chance of a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake occurring within the next 50 years. And then we have another 33% chance of a 6.0 magnitude earthquake occurring from one of our local faults in the next 50 years. And our soils are extremely liquefiable material along both sides of the river. We currently have seven crossings, seven pipes that cross the river, and none of those have been designed for earthquakes. They've all been designed prior to us knowing that we had an earthquake risk in the Portland area, let alone in Oregon. And we, based on talking to ODOT, we figure that we're going to lose at least all of the bridges in the downtown core area, and that will take out at least three of our crossings from liquefaction and then probably damage some of the rest of those from the bridges falling as well. What we're proposing to do is replace one good solid line crossing the line underneath the Willamette River. about 4,000 feet long, which is about 8 of the big pink buildings laid on their side in terms of distance, in a 42-inch diameter pipe. And we're planning to use horizontal directional drilling is the method that we're using. People call it a relatively new technology. It's an innovative way of doing it so that you can drill under the river with minimal impacts to the environment and to the property owners adjacent to it. Unfortunately, it requires a very highly technical, qualified contractor and very specialized equipment. Our preferred alignment is generally going from just north of the Markham Bridge on the east side over to the west side. And the reason we say it's a preferred alignment or a potential alignment is that until we actually hire the design build contractor, the actual termination points on each side are unknowns, and we still have to work with the property owners to verify that we can do it and to minimize the impacts to the commerce and on both sides. The proposed alignment does go underneath the liquefiable soils on both sides. Currently, our existing pipes lay right on the bottom of the river, about in very shallow trenches, less than 3 feet deep. And the new proposed line will be about 80 feet deep, going through more competent soil underneath. We have a project budget of $57 million. $40 million of it is for the proposed design build contractor. $4 million of it is for a owner's rep contract, and then the rest is for internal staffing, permits, easements, and property acquisition stuff that we have to do. The project is actually in the five-year CIP capital improvement project budget, and it's in planning phase, so it has a low confidence rating according to the City Council's resolution with a 50% contingency. Both contracts will be meeting the city's MWESB goals for participation. The owner's rep project is the RFP, request for proposal, will include the goals and corporate responsibility evaluation criteria. The design build request for proposal will include the MWESB goals in the PTE and in the construction work, and we will be asking the contractor to actually provide us a plan with how he would meet those goals. Corporate responsibility is the way procurement uses it.
Why not have that in the design build contract?
I believe it is.
Okay.
It's just worded differently. Sorry. We put it in all of our solicitations.
Okay. Is somebody going to go into more detail about the use of minority?
Okay. Christina's.
I can answer any questions you might have right now. As far as Commissioner Saltzman's question, both RFPs will have that corporate responsibility evaluative criteria. And what we have is there will be different project goals associated because one is a construction contract and one is a professional services contract.
We are asking for two actions. The first ordinance is for you to authorize the alternative findings and to authorize an exemption of the competitive bidding requirements and to allow us to use the design-build method as our alternative procurement and authorize the payments for construction. The second ordinance is to authorize solicitation for the owner's rep project, which is a PTE service contract, and that would be using our traditional qualifications-based selection and RFP process. Design-build, what it is we hire one contractor that provides both the design and the construction, and we hire them up front immediately after planning. And then they work with us to design the project and then to start building it. And they can start doing their designs or their construction as soon as pieces of the contract are designed and ready to go and permitted. What that compares to a traditional project, what we normally do is of a design bid build or a low bid contract. That's where we design, take the project all the way through design with one consultant or in-house, and then we bid, we advertise the project for bidding, and then we open the bids at the end of that phase, and then we award a contract to the lowest responsible contractor based on dollars. What the design build does, though, is you put out an RFQ and you get a short list of 3 to 5 firms, and then you decide who you've of those 3 to 5 firms that you want to get more information from, that they've met the qualifications. Then you get their proposal, and your proposal is what includes the how are they going to design it, what's the schedule look like, what's the price commitments look like, and what is their subcontracting plan. And then we make a selection based on the best value and the best qualifications. One of the benefits of using the design build, or one of the big benefits of using design build, is that it allows us to cut a lot of project time out of it so that we can get a hardened seismic crossing a lot sooner. If you consider the traditional bid build, you're going through your design, and then you're going through your bidding, and then you're going through your construction. With the design build, I can actually start construction while I'm still doing some of the design. Some of my other benefits of a design build is that I have earlier integration between the designer and the contractor, and working with my project teams. The design is actually tailored to the contractor and to their equipment and their expertise, whereas a design bid build, I'm designing to the average contractor, and I don't know what equipment they have. And so at the end of design, I may end up having to be, once I start construction, I might have to redo some of the design. We have a much more certainty of costs earlier in the project, and it is a better way of managing our risks to reduce the costs to the city. Industry has done some comparisons between design build and design bid builds, and generally they're saying that your project delivery is much faster and your have less growth in your contract and less growth in your dollars by doing the design build, which is one of the reasons why we chose this method. As I mentioned earlier, we're looking for, today we're looking for the first reading of these two, and then in 2 weeks we will come back for the second reading and your approval of both ordinances, and then in 2016 and 2017, we will be coming back with reports to council to accept the two projects or the two contracts, and then hopefully in 2019 we will be done with the project and a report to council accepting the project as complete.
And that concludes our presentation, subject to your questions.
So could you go into more detail on the minority involvement, and then I'm wondering why there's no discussion of a community benefits agreement for a project of this size?
Do you want to address the minority first?
That's correct. So the actions before you today, as Teresa mentioned, are two separate solicitations. And the first one is the owner's rep RFP, which will be a professional services. It will have our city policy of a 20% MWESB participation, corporate responsibility evaluative criteria that takes into consideration a certification at the prime level, subcontracting dollars to certified firms, workforce diversity, community involvement, and sustainable business practices. So that's the first action. The second action solicitation is an RFP for the design builder, and that will have the corporate responsibility. It will also have our standard construction, 35% of subcontracting dollars to construction firms. As the design has a element of professional services in it, because there's some design going on there, we have an opportunity to ask for participation from professional services firms in that RFP as well. So our hope is that we actually have participation at both levels, because we can put different goals on the two different pieces of the project as they're combined under one. And then ultimately, at the end, we will have a subcontractor and supplier plan that is negotiated with the general contractor that then becomes part of their contract, in where they are committing to the city in meeting certain goals through the contract design phase and the construction phase.
So how is that weighted when you are evaluating the best value?
Generally, that's 20% of the points for the corporate responsibility criteria.
Does corporate responsibility involve more than just minority contracting?
It has the sustainable business practices and workforce and community involvement as well in there.
And what about the issue of community benefits?
When we thought about the community benefits agreement, we decided that this wasn't really an appropriate contract vehicle, and let me explain a little bit about that. The number is large, and the reason the number is large is we have a long pipe that goes underneath the river. And the work is largely done someplace between 90 and 95% of the work is actually done by the prime contractor. If you can imagine two holes on both sides of the river and a small number of people working in both holes, that's what you see. So the bulk of this work will not be subcontracted out. It will be done by the specialty prime contractor. When you looked at something like the interstate contract, there's probably hundreds of different trades involved, dozens of subcontractors, and a huge percentage of the dollars are not necessarily performed by the prime contractor. They're performed by all the subs. There's lots of opportunity for apprenticeships and so on, which is, in my mind, at least one of the larger benefits of community benefits agreement. That won't exist on this contract because 90, 95% of the work is actually going to be done by the prime contractor. It's just the nature of the work.
Sure, the prime contractor has to be training employees and having people doing the work.
The contractor will have, as part of their corporate responsibility, they have their own MWESB participation that they have to do, but that's separate from the subcontracting opportunity. The subcontracting opportunity is what Mike is talking about. There's only about 5% chance, or 5% of the project being subcontracted out, and the rest is bent.
I get that.
Okay.
I'm just concerned about the level of minority employment. How do we guarantee the level of minority employment by the prime contractor, which we know in some circumstances of our usual folks who come in and bid on these kinds of projects, there is not that many minority folks working in those companies. And then secondly, how we are going to use a percentage of this cost to further workforce development. There's presumably going to be other opportunities to make sure that suppliers and even caterers for their workers and various other things. I'm just surprised that there isn't anything in a $40 million project earmarked for workforce development.
We're asking the contractor to put together a plan of how they're going to provide to meet those goals on their subcontracting opportunities.
So, and as far as the workforce development, so our standard city policy for our 20% apprenticeship requirement and 18% minority and 9% women workers will apply to the prime contract and any subcontracts over $100,000. So the workforce piece that you're talking about is still going to be incorporated into this contract, and the prime contractor will be responsible for that. what Mike and Teresa are alluding to is the subcontracting opportunities are minimal. So any subcontractors that work on this project, likely over $100,000, will have the same requirements. It's just that those opportunities are fewer because of the type of work this is.
Is there an opportunity on a project of this magnitude to require or put points in the solicitation to choose the prime contractor to encourage them to do more than the city's minimum standards for minority and women participation in their work?
Well, and that's the commissioner. That's the good part about using this alternative procurement method, which we're asking for the recommendation, is we can use that RFP evaluation criteria. So in the RFP, we're going to say what the standard city goals are. Our desire is that you exceed that. They get evaluated on that, and any contractor that will come in with trying to exceed the standard goals most likely will then get a higher score in that area.
So I think we're getting close to what I'm trying to get to here, and that is, why aren't we specifying in this ordinance what those higher goals should be, given that we're not doing the standard 1% community benefit agreement?
Well, first of all, let me just be clear. We don't have a standard 1% community benefit agreement. And second, in this project simply doesn't apply. And that's why we briefed execs, each commissioner's office, through their chief of staff. That's why we've gone through Fred Miller. That's why we've gone through the city's committee. It actually doesn't fit. We have another project in the queue which is more likely to fit, which is the reservoir project. So because the CBA doesn't fit, we go back to the other values baked into our contracting, which we're going to be very aggressive on. But it's apples and oranges. This project doesn't, it's a square peg in a round hole. And therefore, the considered judgment is to say the CBA does not apply to this contract, but will likely apply to the next contract in the queue.
My question, though, was, why isn't there a specific target above and beyond the minimums that we require any prime contractor to do in this very large project?
Well, that's not existing city policy. So you want to do a one-off for this particular project to set new standards? I mean, we have existing contract standards. This we haven't raised that in the context of other capital projects for the Water Bureau or other bureaus. I'm happy, as a member of the council, I'm happy to have that conversation more generally. I don't know if it's necessarily appropriate to do it as a one-off for this project.
We have a city policy that says for large projects over $15 million that there is a community benefits agreement.
No, that's not actually what our policy says. We have a policy that says where appropriate. And on this one, we've made a considered judgment that it's not appropriate. We have briefed your office and every other office, execs. We've gone through Fred, maybe Fred, we can have Fred come up and describe it. We've had actually no one on the second floor who has dissented from the view that this doesn't apply. If you have a different view, we're more than happy to have that conversation.
Well, it doesn't sound like you are. It sounds like you said, I can't have that conversation.
No, I said that we have had an extensive briefing with your office and other offices about this.
And when I was briefed by my chief of staff, I said, what about the community benefits agreement and what about the minority? Has the commission weighed in on this?
Fred, why don't you come forward and give us an update?
I have to leave.
Okay. He's feeling abandoned.
I'd love that.
But that normally happens when you're an elected official, not a senior appointed official.
Hi, Fred Miller, director of OMF. What's the question for me?
Has the commission weighed in on that this doesn't?
I briefed the ECPC, Equitable Contracting Procurement Committee, on. I started off with briefing on the Portland building, saying that we have put aside 1%. And now have to determine how that will be used. At the same time, I said the city has done a number of things related to community benefits. There's the Parks Community Benefit Plan, the two modified agreements on water projects. BES has done a community benefit opportunities. There are lots of ideas there. And this one I said about what Mike had said, that this doesn't seem applicable. When there's a pipeline through a community, there's a neighborhood. There's no neighbor here, and it's a very technical project. So I think, and the other thing is that the council, prior to my arriving, had basically looked at the model community benefit agreement and said, try these two water projects, evaluate them, and come back and report. The evaluation is not yet done. I think that's intended for January. So I'm reluctant from a Portland view, before we see if there's a payoff for that, to apply a community benefits agreement. In this project, it just seems like the arguments that have been made make sense. And I did say that to the ECPC.
Did they agree?
They didn't. There was no vote. Someone got back to me an email and said, oh, sure, we wouldn't apply it to that one.
Okay. Thank you. That's what I was asking.
I want to be very clear, though, that the issues that Commissioner Fritz is raising about creating opportunity, about the spirit of the CBA, we take very seriously. In fact, the Water Bureau, I think, has been the poster bureau for putting them into place. And we have a reservoir project in the queue that is going to create, I think, substantial opportunities. It was the considered view for some time that this project didn't fit within that framework. And we have been as transparent as possible with our partners in discussing that. And that is, again, the judgment of all the professionals I rely on.
So I did have a question about the owner's representative and the $4 million. So is an owner's representative a firm or an individual, typically?
It can be an individual or a firm. More than likely, it will be a firm. It could also be a joint venture firm. Most likely an engineering firm and some subs under them that would be providing us some project management expertise and writing the RFP for the design build. And so it's a contractor, a consultant that is familiar with doing design builds and what the solicitation goes, and then helping us work through the process of design and construction.
It's a technique that we used on Sandy River Crossing, which we also did design build. And not only do they help you with the design build documents and so on themselves, you partly hire them for their expertise, in this case, in horizontal directional drilling. So I think they make a really valuable contribution to a project. And as you can imagine, on a project of this size, there's a huge administrative burden that goes along with it. It worked very well for us on Sandy River Crossing.
Some of the other tasks that we're going to have them do is to work with us on going through the permitting requirements and on the public involvement aspects. So those are also subcontracting opportunities, by the way.
Are you going to do this for the reservoir also?
The reservoir is being procured under CMGC. So we don't have an owner's rep for that. And frankly, we feel we have expertise in building reservoirs.
Right.
Thanks. She's sitting right there.
Yes.
Yes.
I think
right
I know
here.
Her.
The questions?
I just wanted to say thank you for observing in the presentation that we don't just have the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake to worry about. We have all sorts of potential little local earthquakes to worry about, too.
Portland Hills Fault, primarily magnitude 6 capable earthquake, which we're sitting very near.
Thank you. Do you have others to present?
No, ma'am.
No.
We're here to answer any questions that come up through the public testimony.
Thank you. Do we have a sign-up sheet?
Yes, we have 3 people signed up. Please come on up. Our Steve Donovan, Jeremy King, and Lightning Watchdog PDX.
Please come on up.
The first 2 do not want to testify.
Steve and Jeremy, does that mean you got all your questions answered through the presentation? And you have a copy of the handout? Good. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Lightning, you have the entire floor.
My name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Watchdog PDX. I do agree with the project itself on the seismic situation here. One of the concerns I have is that I noticed that on the Ross Island you had twin 24-inch steel pipes going across that bridge. My understanding, you're going to do a 42-inch diameter underneath the river. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, we've had a couple new bridges currently built, which my understanding would be up to seismic standards. Now, using a 42-inch diameter pipe, could we not run that pipe along one of these bridges? Now, the reason why I ask that is that you're talking a depth of 85, and I think I read up to 150 feet below. But one of the concerns I have is that when you have a pipe at that distance below the river, what happens if something does go wrong with that pipe? What are the possibilities of repairing that pipe at, say, 85 to 150 feet below the river? Very difficult, and that's one of my biggest concerns here. And that's why I prefer to have, if we could run a pipe above, maybe along a bridge, obviously, would be my first choice to have access to work on it in the event of a problem. Now, I understand you have numerous pipes that run at the river bottom currently, and I know that would be very difficult to repair also. So I guess from my position, I'm just looking at it from a repair standpoint of this new pipe and an understanding on why we could not run a 42-inch diameter pipe along one of the newer bridges, and also have an understanding that if the other pipes fail, and I'm just calculating, say, three pipes at 90-inch diameter total, a 42-inch diameter capacity obviously isn't going to be able to do probably everything we need to do, if I am correct, if we have a serious problem like this. But I see this as a backup plan, if I'm correct, or will this also be currently hooked up upon completion and be used at the same time? So I just have some questions that I maybe threw out here, and maybe somebody could answer that.
Lightning,
thank you for your time.
As usual, they're very thoughtful. So we'll bring up the chief engineer and the director to answer them directly.
Thank you.
So Mike and Teresa, while you're getting settled, question number one is, why not run the new pipe along an existing bridge, which I assume at least have the advantage of being less expensive? If the other pipes fail, what's the capacity of this pipe, and what's our assumption there? And number three, if there is some kind of seismic event, how do we make repairs, given that it goes to a depth of 100 and something feet?
Okay.
So let me start with the first one. And you'll note I've brought up Dave Peters, who's ran until 2 days ago our design section. We actually did talk to TriMet. We can't add a big pipe to an existing bridge. I don't pretend to be an expert in bridge design, but a water pipe full is considered a dead load. It means it's there all the time.
It's very heavy.
Traffic is, it's much lighter than a water pipe. So if we were to put our pipe on a new bridge, can't just add it to an older bridge. The way that works, and we worked with TriMet when we were looking at putting on the pretty new bridge that they've got, is they look at dead load and they assign cost of basically what your load contribution is to the construction of the bridge, which is fair in their lights. So not only would we get to pay for our water pipe, we would also have to pay a very, very large share of the cost of the bridge design. And if you need more detail than that, Dave can talk about it. But we actually looked at it. It is more cost effective for us to build our own line.
That's a very succinct and clear answer. So let's go to his second question about capacity in the event of a system failure.
So it actually has a 42-inch pipe has the capacity of 100 million gallons, which meets our average day demand, and so on the west side as well as within the city. So we feel that during a seismic event, we could live with the one line during average day, not during the summer peak, but during average day we could. Having multiple pipes provides us with the redundancy and the reliability
having one good seismically hardened line provides that same reliability. It just doesn't provide the redundancy.
And Mike, remind me on a fairly below average day, we're about 75 million gallons.
Something like that.
And sometimes during the hot summer months, we peak out at 150, 160.
Yeah.
Something that's like for the whole city.
For the whole city.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. And then, I'm sorry.
Well, I think Lightning's question was, are all six of those pipes in service at the same time?
Actually,
do we sort of rotate amongst?
All six of those pipes are in service.
So they're all providing some combination to get
right, and they,
100 million gallons a day?
Right.
It's very complicated to actually analyze this. We've been building what we call the West Side Header to move water from north to south on the west side of the river. Until then, our pipe system grew basically as the city grew, and that's how come we end up with basically six pipes, five crossings in the central business area. And right now they're all running. We have a couple that are problematic, and as soon as we get this 42-inch done, we're going to deactivate them. Because
Yes, the remaining.
In particular, one to talk about, if you recall spring or fall, we had a leak on the Clay Street crossing. It's one of the oldest crossings, and it's wearing out. And as soon as we get the 42-inch done, we're going to deactivate that line. But ultimately, water utilities like to have loops and multiple sources. So we'll hopefully never be at the point where there's only one line. Maybe after this earthquake, we'll be in that position, but we'll be looking at ways to get another line there because we like being redundant and having multiple feeds to a different particular area.
So his third question.
How do we, if there is some kind of seismic event, are there some challenges we'll face in making repairs to a pipe given that it's buried 100 and something feet below?
It will probably be welded steel pipe, and that's actually a fairly easy pipe. At 42-inch diameter, you can send the diver down through the pipe, which is what we did on Clay Street, and make the repairs from inside. You can also send them. In this case, you can't send them outside, but you can repairs from inside. You can also slip a new pipe inside that 42-inch.
But on the whole, a pipe that's in rock at that depth, there's so much pressure around it, and pipes, it may sound kind of counterintuitive, but they're actually flexible under high pressure, and they perform very, very well in seismic events.
Another reason why it's a good place to be a pipe, huh?
Yes, it is.
Here we go. Colleagues,
stole your line.
Colleagues, Teresa and Mike worked long and hard on this PowerPoint presentation, and it's a fairly dry presentation, a lot of technical information, and I want to compliment them for the way they present the information. We did want to spice it up, though, at the end. We buried some treasure in this PowerPoint. Steve, you're not allowed to go through it, but we conspicuously buried treasure. And if any of you can identify where the treasure was buried, there is some swag from the Water Bureau that we're going to present to you.
can't look at it?
Well, I'll give you a hint. If you look at the geologic cross-section slide.
pull it up.
Is that Portlandia?
We buried some treasure.
Desperate for entertainment, Commissioner.
We're testing a thesis about whether when you hand out a PowerPoint, people actually read them. So we put some buried treasure in one of the slides. We have one other housekeeping matter, Madam President. I will be gone next week.
Let me just close this public hearing, if you don't mind.
Okay.
These are both moved to second reading. Thank you very much for the good presentation.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fish, I will recognize you for the next.
Thank you. A housekeeping matter is I will not be here next week, so we've asked that the second reading occur on December 16th.
Okay, so this will move to second reading the week after next. Commissioner Saltzman, I understand you're not going to be at the public hearing tonight. Is that correct?
Correct.
So, Commissioners Fish and Novick, we won't be able to take any breaks in the session tonight, so be sure you go to the bathroom before we do. Before we get there, we will be adjourned. We have a public hearing tonight at 6 o'clock at the Middleman Jewish Community Center, 6651 Southwest Capitol Highway, for the purpose of hearing the supporting documents for the update of the Portland Comprehensive Plan and the Comprehensive Plan. Sign-ins will be taken in order of the people signing up, and the sign-out sheets will be available an hour ahead of time. So we are adjourned until 6 o'clock.